Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dory Smith.
Well, if we don't break the back of the permanent war economy, we're finished. And neither of the two main political parties even raise it as an issue.
Chris Hedges joins us for the half hour to talk about his new book, Empire of Illusion, due out in July. We also look at the escalation of the war in Afghanistan and the disease of permanent war. That's the title of his latest commentary piece, featured May 18th in truthdig.com. First, some related headlines. The month of May 2009 brought more grim news for peace activists seeking an end to the Iraq and Afghan wars, trying to stave off wider war in Pakistan, and still reeling from Israel's assaults on Gaza. John Murphy is an organizer with COW, Citizens Oppose War, and the Southeastern Connecticut Peace and Justice Coalition. His group joined Connecticut students against the war for a march from Williams Memorial Park to the gates of the Coast Guard Academy in New London Wednesday morning.
Well, the message today, unfortunately, is the same message that we've had the past year since COW was formed when we've gone to the Coast Guard commencement, and it's for the United States to end the wars of occupation in Iraq and now Afghanistan and our war on Pakistan, and to redirect our military spending toward, first of all, honoring our financial and healthcare commitments to veterans and their families, and to really start taking care of education, healthcare, and jobs in this country, and not be bailing out Wall Street and the banks and the financial institutions that have dragged us to the precipice of a second Great Depression. That was our message 2 years ago at the Coast Guard Academy. It was last year, and it's still the same thing. There were other groups. There were people that were talking about immigrants' rights, because Janet Napolitano, who's the Secretary of Homeland Security, was the commencement speaker this year, and seen as the Homeland Security, Department of Homeland Security, in charge of the ICE raids that have gone after immigrants. There was some messaging about that, but the COW message, again, is the same thing. We need to end these wars. We need to restore our standing in the world by being the leaders that we were in the past, and for us to not really be drawing down our troop strength in Iraq while we're increasing our troop strength in Afghanistan and bombing a lot of innocent civilians with unmanned drones in Pakistan, where the rhetoric's not matching the results and the actions.
In fact, increasingly, the Obama administration seems to be picking up the threads of propaganda left hanging when the Bush team left Washington. Here is Secretary of State Hillary Clinton speaking about a new trade agreement she said would enrich Pakistani and Afghan civilians.
I'm pleased to announce that Afghanistan and Pakistan have reached an important milestone in their efforts to generate foreign investment and stronger economic growth and trade opportunities. Before President Karzai and President Zardari meet with President Obama this morning, the two ministers, Minister Qureshi and Minister Sponto, will sign a memorandum of understanding committing their countries to achieving a trade transit agreement by the end of the year, which we believe will have great economic benefits for both peoples.
In the background, an increase in U.S. military airstrikes in the region were anything but good news for civilians in either country. 1.5 million Pakistani civilians are now in flight in the Swat Valley, where there are heightened battles with the Taliban. Still, the U.S. propaganda machine that grew to a frenzy under Bush-Cheney seems to have been restarted. Or did it ever really stop or even slow down?
If anything, it only has been accelerated. And this was, you're referring to Fulbright's book in 1970, The Pentagon Propaganda Machine.
And what new information do the Americans say they have now?
We talked to an American official who just saw some video taken from the B-1 bomber. And he says it shows Taliban fighters running through the village and also looking for shelter, running into one or two of the houses. And he says the video also includes audio from U.S. soldiers on the ground talking with the pilots about the locations of the Taliban.
This is the latest in a string of incidents where civilians have been killed by mistake in Afghanistan. NPR's Tom Bowman is covering this story.
Pentagon reporters like NPR's Tom Bowman have been articulating the U.S. rationale for the military after U.S. airstrikes killed some 140 civilians in one day in western Afghanistan.
Sometimes U.S. Afghan forces are outnumbered, outgunned by the Taliban. So the military says sometimes you have to rely on airstrikes. So the problem is, in this type of warfare, there's always this tug between protecting civilians and protecting your own troops when they come under heavy fire from the Taliban and other fighters.
NPR's Julie McCarthy reported from Islamabad that the Conservative International Republican Institute, IRI, conducted a survey with results showing Pakistanis support the U.S. in trying to defeat the Taliban. U.S. Senator John McCain and former campaign staffer Randy Shuneman are on the board of the institute, along with Paul Bremer, former U.S. administrator of Iraq, and many others involved in conservative politics, U.S. trade, or war efforts. In an article in SourceWatch, Joshua Kurlancic called IRI the coup connection, reporting it had fostered the overthrow of governments like the Aristide government in Haiti. The IRI has followed economic or political interests abroad in many countries where opposition political figures receive support from the organization.
An opinion poll conducted by the International Republican Institute, a conservative U.S.-based think tank, found that 74% of Pakistanis believe religious extremism is a serious problem in the country. That the Taliban has no intention of ending its insurgency was clear last month, when, fresh from a peace agreement in Swat, they spilled into neighboring Bunair. Politician and Pakistan Muslim League General Secretary Mushahid Hussain Syed says the Taliban's relentless drive persuaded Pakistanis that a peace deal with militants was worthless.
And when they saw those people in their true colors, I think the people of Pakistan have spoken, and they support the military action.
IRI has been active in Haiti and a wide variety of other countries where it sought out political figures helpful to U.S. interests. The Hearts and Minds campaign has been jump-started, too, and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has promised $110 million in humanitarian aid for displaced Pakistanis. This amid renewed discussion about terrorism, al-Qaeda, and an increase in pro-war coverage by the corporate press as 25,000 more U.S. troops head to Afghanistan. Over the next two programs, Chris Hedges helps us understand the meaning of this next phase of what former Secretary of State Donald Rumsfeld called the Long War. Chris Hedges has covered wars in Central America, the Mideast, and the Balkans, reporting from some 50 countries. Chris Hedges is author of many books, including his recent bestseller, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, plus the more recent American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America, and earlier texts, such as What Every Person Should Know About War. Chris Hedges also received wide acclaim for an earlier book, Losing Moses on the Freeway. But it is books like Collateral Damage, America's War Against Iraqi Civilians, that has given him a reputation as a leader amongst reporters covering human rights. In 2002, Chris Hedges received the Amnesty International Global Award for Human Rights Journalism. He has taught at Columbia University, New York University, and Princeton University. Chris Hedges, welcome.
Thank you.
Your books always have such fascinating titles. Tell us the full title of your new book and the meaning of that title.
It's called Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle. And it is about living in a non-reality-based belief system, failing to grasp what's happening around us. Across the cultural spectrum, you see it, that belief that we can be anything we want to be, you know, whether that's given to us by Jesus, whether it's Oprah finding our inner strength, self-help gurus, it's certainly part of corporatism. Reality is never an impediment to what you want. And in a time of collapse, that becomes very dangerous because the chasm between what is real and what you think is real widens to such an extent that it, I think, eventually dictates a kind of deep existential shock. And it is an attempt to juxtapose the illusion of who we think we are as a country and a people with who we really are.
And in your piece in Truth Dig, The Disease of Permanent War, you write, citizens in a state of permanent war are bombarded with the insidious, militarized language of power, fear, and strength that mask an increasingly brittle reality.
I have to go back and lean pretty heavily on the great scholar Seymour Melman in books like Pentagon Capitalism, where he described in great detail the huge expansion of the defense and military industries following the Second World War. He actually calls the defense industry a viral and explains how this sort of state of permanent war, which has existed for, you know, the last few decades, has upended priorities. It's redirected government expenditures, of course, half of all discretionary spending to gigantic military projects. And the consequences of that is that domestic investment has been diminished and starved in the name of national security so that we can produce these sophisticated fighter jets like the F-22, and Boeing is unable to finish commercial planes on schedule. We roll out one M1 Abrams tank after another, and our automobile industry is going bankrupt. We divert grants and money and research funds into the development of weapons, and we fail to build the technology of renewable energy to fight global warming. Universities, and I've taught at Princeton and Columbia and NYU, are completely awash in defense-related grants at Princeton. My understanding is that the entire robotics department is funded by the defense industry. And, you know, not only are the humanities withering away, but things like environmental sciences are not being funded. These are all consequences of a society that has descended into what Melman, I think, correctly calls a state of permanent war. I mean, we're spending now, if you count the VA and nuclear research and everything else, we're up at almost $1 trillion a year. The stated defense budget is about $623 billion, and according to the CIA, the second largest expenditure by any country on defense is $65 billion, which is China. All we have to do is look around to see the disintegration, the physical disintegration that the permanent war economy has visited on the country, bridges and levees collapsing, schools decaying, domestic manufacturing base virtually destroyed, staggering debts, the callousness by which we treat the weak, the poor, the mentally ill, the sick, the unemployed. All these sacrifices are somehow supposed to be necessary in the name of national security. And when you live, as we do, in a state of permanent war, you are bombarded by people, of course, for whom this is a huge profit-making enterprise, with the militarized language of war, power, fear, strength, that I think is used to mask this sort of gradual collapse. And that's what's infected the country, that we have these large corporations who push the doctrine of permanent war, have kind of upended or tweaked Leon Trotsky's doctrine of permanent revolution. It's just permanent war, but the effect is the same, which is to keep us afraid so that we don't object to the bloated military budget, so that we don't ask the unpleasant questions of those in power, and that we're willing to have our rights and liberties stripped from us. And that's all part of the same and very frightening package, which I think Melman was one of the first to sort of begin to understand.
And you mentioned that the military-industrial establishment is a very lucrative business, and it's gilded corporate welfare. Talk about the guarantee of profits, even as most of America worries about their paychecks.
Yeah, well, that's one of the, you know, the most insidious aspects of the permanent war economy. And again, I'm going to have to go back to the person, I think, who enlightened me to this, Melman, who, you know, in his research found that since the end of World War II, the federal government has devoted more than half of all tax dollars to military and current and future military operations. This is by far the largest single sustaining activity of the government. But how does it work financially? And it has become, for the military-industrial complex, which Eisenhower originally wanted to call the military-industrial-academic complex, which is sort of interesting, an extremely lucrative form of corporate welfare. Because defense systems are sold before they're ever produced. And not only that, but military industries are permitted to charge the federal government for gigantic cost overruns, meaning that huge profits are guaranteed. And how do we give foreign aid to, let's say, Egypt, where I used to be based for the New York Times? Egypt gets, this is also true with Israel, but gets $3 billion a year in assistance. But they are required in that assistance package to buy or to spend $1.3 billion of that money on American weapon systems. So you have this kind of circular route where the taxpayers fund the research and the development and the building of the weapon systems. And then they give money to foreign governments to buy them back. It defies any semblance of, you know, free market economics. And what happens to these weapon systems? Well, they're very soon in need of being updated and, of course, replaced by a new generation of weapon systems that are always more sophisticated and more costly. So they end up, you know, being hauled off into the desert where they're left to rust. In economic terms, it's a completely dead end. It sustains nothing except the permanent war economy. And that virus has, at this point, I think, gone extremely far in hollowing out American society from the inside, that we are a country that, because it's in a permanent war economy, is not constricted or controlled by the normal economic rules of producing goods. I'm talking about the large corporations that have made this unholy alliance, or, you know, essentially turned the government, the federal government, into a kind of partner in this process. They don't produce goods and sell them for a profit and then use the profit for further investment and production. They operate completely outside of the whole concept of competitive markets. There are no competitive markets. They've erased the line between the state and the corporation. And what they've really been able to do, and of course through lobbyists and sophisticated public relations, the Pentagon spends millions and millions of dollars a year making sure that we have a particular image of not only the world but of the military. It leeches away the ability of the country to manufacture useful and sustainable products and create sustainable jobs. And Melman studied the example of the New York City Transit Authority in 2003 when it allocated $3 to $4 billion for new subway cars. So the New York City asked for bids, and there weren't any American companies that responded because these large manufacturing concerns have found a much more lucrative deal integrating themselves into the permanent war economy. So the corrosion or the corruption of the industrial base is one that diverts resources from items that maintain or improve the economy and the nation's infrastructure. And what happened? Well, finally, New York City had to contract with companies in Japan and Canada to build its subway cars. Now, this contract alone, directly and indirectly, would have created about 32,000 jobs in the United States. And that's just a small example of what happens repeatedly in a permanent war economy, and an economy that has been completely distorted, as ours has.
You're listening to Talk Nation Radio. We're speaking with renowned journalist Chris Hedges. Chris Hedges graduated from Harvard Divinity School and was a war correspondent writing for the Christian Science Monitor, the Dallas Morning News, and the New York Times, where he spent 15 years and was on a team that won the 2002 Pulitzer Prize for the paper's coverage of global terrorism. You mentioned in your piece the late Senator J. William Fulbright and his description in 1970, how the Pentagon influenced and shaped public opinion through these multi-million-dollar public relations campaigns even then. So we're talking about close ties between the Pentagon government and Hollywood producers and the use of the media by the Defense Department, or, you know, creation of basically propaganda films. Now we're seeing that maybe that never ended when the Bush administration left Washington, right? It's going on again, but not that it ever stopped, right?
No. If anything, it only has been accelerated. And this was, you're referring to Fulbright's book in 1970, The Pentagon Propaganda Machine, where he detailed how public opinion is shaped through huge advertising programs directed at the public, Defense Department films, very close ties with Hollywood producers, and the use of lobbying and commercial media to gain support for weapons systems that, you know, you saw a window into that with Barry McCaffrey, this retired four-star Army general, this is in a New York Times story, where he was being used as a CNN analyst at the same time that he was an employee for Defense Solutions Incorporated, a consulting firm, so that on air he not only promoted wars, which directly affected the profit margins of the company he worked for, but the weapon systems that they sold. So here you have, ostensibly a dispassionate military analyst calling for the expansion of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the use of specific weapon systems for which he personally made a profit.
And yet the soldiers on the ground, Brigadier Mark Carlton Smith, for example, October 2008, speaking with a Reuters reporter named Jonathan Birch, says the Afghan war isn't winnable militarily, has to be won through political means, political engagement. These are the people that see this war from a different perspective, perhaps, and maybe are invested in a different way.
Well, the reason Obama and the Pentagon are frantically flying in soldiers and Marines to Afghanistan is because we are losing the war, and the advances of the Taliban are terrifying. The Karzai government is collapsing. The Taliban is carrying out daylight attacks inside the capital, Kabul. When we first went into Afghanistan in 2001, the Taliban controlled about 75% of the country. It has reconstituted itself. The UN estimates that it brings in $300 million a year to fund the insurgency through the poppy and heroin trade, and it now controls 50% of the country. In the South, as a foreigner, you can't travel in the South unless you're embedded. You can't even walk the streets of Kabul. It's too dangerous. You have to go in a cab. And you certainly don't go outside the city limits unless, again, you're embedded with NATO forces, and that's true in Kandahar as well. So, you know, you often hear the argument in both Iraq and Afghanistan that American forces need to stay because if they left, there was chaos. And this, of course, has a bizarre logic if you are intimately familiar with Iraqi society as I am, because, of course, the presence of foreign occupation troops is one of the major causes of instability. And we see now in a very similar situation to what happened during the Vietnam War with Cambodia, where we are carrying the war over the border into Pakistan because we not only have declared war on the Taliban, but in essence we've declared war on the Pashtuns, 18 million of whom live in Afghanistan, 23 million of whom live immediately over the border into Pakistan because, of course, the line was drawn by British cartographers without any respect to tribal areas. And the heavy use of drones, along with the heavy use of American airstrikes, I mean, you know, just had this incident earlier this month where, you know, up to 140 civilians were killed, has really created a situation where we have become the most effective recruiting tools that the Taliban has. And throwing more troops into Afghanistan is like dumping gasoline all over the fire. It isn't going to work.
We've heard a lot of different reports on these airstrikes in western Afghanistan that were so devastating to civilians. There was the downsizing of numbers, the blame the U.S. put on Taliban fighters rather than airstrikes, explanations about film from the planes. Now on NPR, we've heard about a poll taken in Pakistan by a conservative organization that showed the majority of civilians there don't support the Taliban, do support the military effort and the U.S. In this thread of logic, we have a cause again, much like we did in Iraq, the saving of the people of Pakistan and Afghanistan from the Taliban.
Well, the support for the Taliban, I think, is largely propelled forward by the corruption and brutality of the Karzai government. Very similar situation in Gaza, where people walked away from Fatah because they were so brutal and corrupt into the arms of Hamas. There's never been any deep love for the Taliban. Remember, the Taliban are largely our creation. During the 80s, when there was the battle against the 10-year Soviet occupation, the CIA funded only the most extreme Mujahideen elements, which of course became the Taliban and starved secular opposition movements within Afghanistan. It turned out to be a very short-sighted and counterproductive strategy, one largely pushed on the Americans by the ISI, or the Pakistani Intelligence Service, which was allowed to administer the aid out of Peshawar and other places. So the Afghans are very aware of the fact that it was we, as Americans, who funded, armed, and empowered the Taliban. And that's why there's such a deep distrust in Afghanistan of the Americans and their motivations and intentions. But I think it's clear that a lot of the savagery of the Taliban is very unpalatable to large numbers of Afghans. And tragically, what you have in Afghanistan are two different forms of barbarity. You know, one side beheads human beings and throws acid in girls' faces, and the other side drops 1,000-pound iron fragmentation bombs and shiny cluster bombs all over fields where children and innocents are murdered and maimed. And that is the disease of war. But I think we are incredibly naive if we don't understand that in the mix of Afghanistan, there is no moral difference between us and the Taliban.
Between us and Gulbuddin Hekmatyar? I think that's who you were referring to.
Well, Hekmatyar received staggering sums of money. He's a creation of the CIA.
And the State Department saw him as a terrorist. Still, Congress funded him.
Yeah. Well, you know, yeah, I mean, that's a perfect example of, you know, whoever coined that term, blowback. I mean, he would have been nothing without us. And we allowed the Saudis in there. We allowed Wahhabism to come in. You know, we played a major role in distorting not only Afghan society, but Afghan opposition.
If the choice is between them and us, they're choosing them at least much of the last 8 years.
Well, because they're Afghans. I mean, let's not forget the Taliban is an indigenous movement, and we're not. And you sort of wonder if these people read history. Go back and look at the failed 10-year Soviet occupation. 15,000 Red Army troops dead, you know, many, many more maimed and wounded, a client army that reached close to 200,000, completely riddled with corruption and ineffectual. We're repeating the mistakes that, just as we went into Vietnam and repeated the mistakes of the French, we're walking into Afghanistan repeating the mistakes of the Soviets.
Well, I suppose the warnings you issue in your books are an answer in and of themselves. But what is the answer in terms of organizing what we have to do here?
Well, if we don't break the back of the permanent war economy, we're finished. And neither of the two main political parties even raise it as an issue. It's not sustainable in terms of its military objectives, but it's also just not sustainable economically. We are exhausting ourselves, and imperiums which have this kind of constant need to expand always do this, to a point where there's going to be a radical kind of deflation, because it's not over the long term sustainable. And I think that, you know, almost everything I write is an attempt to, at least in my eyes, get people to grasp the reality around them. You know, I spent many, many years as a war correspondent, and it's not a matter of being a pessimist or an optimist. It's a matter of understanding what's down at the end of that road and how dangerous it is. And people in war zones who couldn't read the landscape realistically often didn't live very long. And I think that the political mechanisms are largely impotent and bankrupt. And I think you're right, require a kind of organizing and a challenging against the machine and the system that, if it's done, will ensure our kind of willful self-annihilation.
Christopher Hedges, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Not at all. Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with Chris Hedges. You can read his weekly columns at truthdig.com. His forthcoming book is Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle. We'll hear more from him next time as we take a look at the corporate press and the Pentagon's new and old messages ripening again under the Obama administration. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced in the studios of Talk Nation Radio in Storrs, Connecticut. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions.